This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Thor Ragnarok, A Bad Mom's Christmas, Goodbye Christopher Robin, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, and The Florida Project. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Alfred Hitchcock. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Once again, I need to go into this territory of talking about uncomfortable situations, some uncomfortable topics, and we're going to talk a little bit about some more of that sexual harassment, sexual assault going on in Hollywood that's coming to light. And as I have in the past, I'm going to take a bit of an alternative take, call it a hot take, if you will. And a lot of this comes from the Twitter echo chamber. Social media is a great thing, but social media can also be abused, and social media is essentially a giant gossiping platform. And it's enough for people to point fingers and accuse people, and with no proof or anything like that, after the Harvey Weinstein stuff broke, I was critical of the Me Too campaign. And the reason I'm critical of that is it's not as much about bringing light on the subject, but the Me Too campaign seems to be more about, I need to tell my story and the consequences be damned. And we see that with the Kevin Spacey allegations, where an actor, he's on Star Trek Discovery and he's in his 40s now, but he said when he was 14 years old, like 30 years ago, Kevin Spacey, he said, sexually propositioned him, and he was 14 and Spacey was 26, and this blew up, and it blew up in two different weird ways. And this is where I think the problem is. The first way it blew up is Kevin Spacey came out and said, I don't remember this happening, but if I did, I apologize. And oh, by the way, I'm gay. And that got him in trouble, rightfully so, with gay advocacy groups, because I think in Spacey's mind, he was trying to explain why there would have been an attraction to a man, and it's him saying, hey, I'm gay, that's why this would kind of maybe make sense. But it came across as associating gayness with pedophilia, and that's not true. This myth that gay people have been struggling for years to distance themselves, the way Spacey handled it, he's really stepped in a bear trap with that. So that blew up in that respect, and that was just an awkward and an inappropriate way of him to deal with it. But here's my problem with this particular accusation. It's also turned into sexual assault allegations. People say, we need to call it what it is. It's sexual assault. And I read the original story, and it's that he kind of just pushed up against the person, and he almost cornered him, wouldn't let him out of the room or something like that. But again, I have to say, we need to stop redefining sexual assault as something that's not actually sexual assault. Sexual assault is actually forcing sex on someone. The definition is getting homogenized so much that people are being held up as saying they're a sexual predator if they do something inappropriate, or like a drunk person at a party, as opposed to cornering somebody and forcing sex on them. And there's a difference there. I think we can agree that there's a difference. Now, the other thing about this was a private party. It was not an industry party. It was not part of the production that they were working on. So here's my question. What does this have to really do with Hollywood? And on top of it, why did he wait this long? And I know everyone says, oh, well, don't blame the victim. But here's the deal. People falsely accuse other people of stuff all the time. And when it comes to unwanted sexual advances, as I've said before, it's often about perception and not necessarily about truth. And this Me Too campaign has gotten people to say, I'm just going to make these accusations on Twitter or on an article, or have Roman Pharaoh add me to one of his many articles about people who have been sexually harassed, and suddenly it gives you power, and it gives you a notice, and it gives you a certain image of the glamours, and you become the victim. But there are people who do, in fact, and have, in fact, falsely accused people. And I think what this is going to force to have happen, because every production, every movie, every television show is its own business entity. And those business entities are going to have to do what business entities did in the 90s, where they have to have a sexual harassment policy for every movie you work on and define that. The problem with movies and television is people are constantly on their dating and using it as a dating pool and having sex. And I'm talking both sides, men and women. They see this. And then on top of it, we have entire gossip rags that exist because, oh, this star is having sex with this star. Oh, they're a couple now. Oh, we're going to give them a cute name. Well, doesn't that fall in the inappropriate level of sexual activity in a movie? I mean, like you had Robert Rodriguez say, well, I gave Rose McGowan a job on Planet Terror because I was there to spite Harvey Weinstein. Or maybe you were there to get laid because you did in fact have sex with her, blow up your marriage, and then try and attach her to every project you had in development from that point on. Why isn't that frowned upon? I think what's going to have to happen is productions are going to basically have to install sexual harassment policies from the get-go, and when they hire people, and stick to them. And then when this stuff happens, you bring it up the ranks. But if somebody's just a jerk in everyday life, like there's all this stuff with Brett Ratner, where he meets people and he does inappropriate things. I'm not defending Brett Ratner, but maybe he's just a sleazebag, which we all knew already. But if he was doing it on set, that's different. If he's just a sleazebag in real life, that's something different. And if he sexually assaults you, then go to the police. But don't wait for 20 years and then come out and say, oh, well, Brett Ratner offended me. But, you know, look, if this happens, report it. But don't report it on Twitter. That's the thing. People say, well, this is what happens to people who accuse, and then they get attacked. Well, if you accuse on Twitter, there's a difference than going to the police or going to the production or going to the business and reporting it up a chain of command as it's supposed to be done. If it's a crime, it's a crime. Go to the police. If it's breaking company policy, go to the company and follow that up. That's what brought down Bill O'Reilly, were people who actually went through the process of reporting it internally and then suing. If you want to stop that, that's what you got to do. But you get backlash all the time. You get into a conflict of egos with somebody, and there's a lot of egos on a film set. Or look at what's happened with House of Cards. House of Cards is now over because of this allegation. That's great. You took down Kevin Spacey, but look at all these other people who have jobs, who had a job because of House of Cards, and you've ruined it for them too. So that's why I don't like this Me Too, burn it down approach. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Real quick, I want to talk. I spent too much time talking about sex, as I always do. But let's talk about I, Tonya. Opens on December 8th, starring Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding.
America. They want someone to love. But they want someone to hate. And the haters always say, Tonya, tell the truth. There's no such thing as truth. I mean, it's bullshit.
This looks like one another attempt for Margot Robbie to get some sort of award traction. She's a good actor, and the biggest problem she has to do is she has to play a character to get real notice is either one that's not as gorgeous as she is, or it's hypersexualized like Harley Quinn. She's a great actor. I have yet to see much of this movie that looks like it might just end up being just a docudrama that would be on TV. The next one I want to talk about real quickly is Winchester. Opens on February 2nd.
It's a gargantuan seven-storied structure with no apparent rhyme or reason. Each maze of halls more confusing than the next.
It's under never-ending construction. It was built on the orders of a grieving widow.
Do you believe in ghosts, Doctor?
I do not believe in anything I cannot see or study.
Now, this movie looks kind of cool because I've heard the stories of this house and I've always been fascinated by it. the February release date doesn't bother me because that sometimes works for a horror movie. So I'm actually looking forward to it. Helen Mirren in a horror movie? I'm all for that. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about A Bad Mom's Christmas and Goodbye, Christopher Robin. Because we can't go! Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some films to review this week. The first one is A Bad Mom's Christmas. The Bad Moms are back at it again, this time at the holidays while hosting their own Bad Moms as house guests.
I don't think I can do this sober.
You guys want to get drunk at the food court?
Woo! Yeah.
I do this how I like. I'm the boy.
I feel like a giant stress ball from like November to New Year's.
Yeah.
I spend months picking out the perfect present for everyone. You know, the only thing I get in return? Coupons for free back rubs.
That's not okay.
Bad back rubs.
Remember when the holidays were actually fun?
Let's take Christmas back.
The first Bad Moms was actually a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, and I'm not a woman, but the first Bad Moms was definitely made for the girls' night out. It was basically a backlash to the social media presentation of perfect moms. And ever since the internet has come about, everybody struggles to make their family look perfect. And I've read these articles where people say, oh, you know, here's this beautiful picture of us on the beach. But in reality, everybody was fighting and they were crying and they got one good picture, but it was really a horrible day. Now, I've never fallen into that. I don't fall into wanting to become the perfect parent. I'm all about, hey, we're going to have fun or not. We're going to do a family activity and we'll take pictures. Sure. But I'm more interested in having the fun than getting the perfect picture. The first Bad Moms was a great response to that, where people are saying it's okay to just not be perfect. Now, this one is a somewhat forced sequel. I mean, you've got the Bad Moms back. You got Mila Kunis, Kristen Bell, and Katherine Hahn. And the problem is the setup of it is kind of stupid. People do try to do a perfect Christmas. I've known people who try and do it. I've known people who don't give a crap as well. And one of the things that this movie does do is it makes, like Katherine Hahn, her character's kind of the train wreck of the three of them. And she lives in a crappy house with, you know, it's not well designed. It's not well put together. But when you look at her house, it's just an average house. The house that she lives in isn't a slum. It's a house that a lot of people live in. It's a very normal, reasonable house. It's not, you know, like some crappy little hole in the wall apartment. And then the other two live in these really nice houses and that are overly decorated. And that's one of the problems that Hollywood actually has is they overset design what's supposed to be the average person's place. And that plays into the exact thing that they're rebelling against in this movie. Because you walk in these people's houses and it's gorgeous and it's well done. And she's a divorced mother. So the movie does get in its own way of its own messaging at times. The other problem I have with it is, in particular, the relationship that they focus most on, the main story, is Mila Kunis, whose mom is Christine Baranski. And she's basically playing a version of the overly stiff, obnoxious, mean, overbearing mother in The Big Bang Theory, which Christine Baranski does well, but it does feel like there's a lot of jokes that are recycled. And the writing's not as sharp as it could be. There are jokes that don't work, that are overplayed. Like, there's a whole thing joking about, oh, because the girl's talking, the little girl saying, well, were you mad at daddy? Because you were yelling at him. And you played, and she's like, we're playing adult games. And she's like, oh, you played it 7 times. I'm like, 7? If she's too tired to put up a freaking Christmas tree, she should be too tired to have sex 7 times in one night. 7? Now it's just getting ridiculous. This is not how normal people exist. And this is going to that sort of that Grey's Anatomy, every time you have sex is the greatest thing ever. And the joke just is absurd when you put it in this, well, we had sex 7 times? How long is that going to take you? It's either great sex seven times, which is going to take you the entire weekend, or it's lickety split quick. And then you can just do it a couple times in an hour or two. But no wonder you don't get any sleep. And then the little girl drops the F-bomb a couple times, but they keep having her drop the F-bomb. And I'm like, the joke played once and it was funny, but you just keep doing it. It's not funny anymore. So they do recycle and hit jokes over and over again. And the other thing is Christine Baranski's character. That's the weakest of the stories. That's the one that's least funny. The best part's Catherine Hahn and her mom, played by Susan Sarandon, but really more just Catherine Hahn. I'd watch more of her. I think she's hilarious and she steals the show. But still, ultimately, if you're going to want to have a girls' night out and drink some crappy wine and go see a movie that's going to make you laugh, that's the crowd that this is going for. So I'm going to have to say, ultimately, I'm going to say Bad Moms Christmas kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Goodbye Christopher Robin. This biopic looks at how A.A. Milne developed the characters of Winnie the Pooh and the Hundred Acre Wood based on his own son.
You're going to live here. This is your new home.
Mummy says you're writing a book to stop people going to war.
Mm.
I think your book is a jolly good idea.
You're the only one that does.
Can you think of a good name for a donkey?
Eeyore. I think I've got something for us. Ernest and I are putting your bear in a book. We're putting you in it too.
What will you call me in the book?
Your real name, Christopher Robin.
I love Winnie the Pooh. And I think there's a real charm in the original non-Disney version of Winnie the Pooh, the shepherd drawings and the original writing by A.A. Milne. And then, of course, Disney kind of made it their own in the 60s and built their own little genre, really, with multiple films and toys. And they kind of gave it their own spin, but preserved it to a degree. But this is really the original British feel to the book. What this is meant to show is it's meant to show the story of how Christopher Robin, who never went by the name Christopher Robin, he went by the name Billy Moon for his own reasons, how the kid had these toys and how he played with them. And then his father, A.A. Milne, who was a playwright who had gone to war in World War I, developed this into a little cottage industry. And I know what this movie's trying to do. It's trying to show how they took this magic and capitalized on it and kind of squandered it away from Christopher Robin Milne himself. And it shows how, as he grew up, he started to resent and dislike Winnie the Pooh and everything that it meant, because he was kind of thrust in the spotlight when he was just this like 9-year-old kid or 7-year-old kid or something, whenever six, I forget how old he was, when he was really promoting the Winnie the Pooh books. And I guess my biggest problem is they're trying to show the way the Milnes were. In the process, you're just like, these are just really crappy parents. They have a baby and immediately get a nanny and then start going off and doing their own thing. There's no parenting that actually happens in this book. The rare moment where there's actual parenting happening is when Milne is forced to stay with his son for a couple weeks and actually just deal with it because their nanny had to go deal with some family issues. And this may be true, but I'm watching this thing going, this isn't an exercise in how a beloved children's story came about. This is just an exercise in bad parenting. And they're really kind of hard people, especially the mom. And I think they may be either trying to do too much pain or bad, but they're just bad parents. And I could not get past that, mainly because I've raised my kids myself with my wife, of course, but I raise them. I've changed diapers. I've played with them. I've taken them to school. I've done all the work. I don't have a nanny. I don't need a nanny. I never did. And that's because I was a parent. And so I watched this movie and I'm just like, well, this is just souring the idea of Winnie the Pooh and taking a lot of the charm out of it. I know it's meant to show this charming story, but all it did was show what kind of a-holes the Milnes were and how Christopher Robin dealt with things. So in the end, I'm going to have to say that Goodbye Christopher Robin kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Thor Ragnarok and the killing of the sacred deer.
Stop it now.
For
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a couple more movies. The big one for the week is, of course, Thor Fraggle Rock. The mighty Thor finds himself transported where he must battle his old pal, the Hulk.
It's main event time.
We know each other. He's a friend from work.
Oh, come on.
This is the third Thor movie. It gives the story of what Thor was doing after Avengers Age of Ultron. We all know what everybody else was doing because they all got into the Civil War battle with Tony Stark and Captain America. But this is Thor's journey, and of course we all know he meets the Incredible Hulk in this. So you also get to see where the Hulk went, where Bruce Banner ended up. I like the fact that what they're doing with the Marvel movies is they're separating people out when they need to, and they can give a one-off stories that are appropriate. Thor being on Earth is not always gonna work. I mean, Thor's a god and he's kind of Earth's protector, but you gotta let him do his intergalactics fantastic stuff, and you put the Hulk in the movie. What's so funny is the Hulk being in a movie is fantastic. I love the Hulk. Oddly enough, the Incredible Hulk from 2008 is one of the lowest performing Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. I don't know if a Hulk standalone movie is going to do well, but putting him into another film cross-pollinates. And I like the fact that they're breaking it up and just giving you these two guys. Well, you got Loki in there as well. But they have their own journey and they have their own thing to deal with while the people on Earth are dealing with the Earthling stuff. And in this film, there's a lot of influence from the Guardians of the Galaxy. And you actually saw a little preview of Jeff Goldblum in the credits of Guardians of the Galaxy 2 this summer. And this feels like a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. Or rather, it feels like Thor and the Incredible Hulk are working around in a Guardians of the Galaxy universe, where it's bright and colorful, and it doesn't look like Star Wars. It's a very different look at space in the intergalactic world. And it's also very, very funny. It's directed by the guy who did films like The Hunt for the Wilder People and What We Do in the Shadows. He's a Kiwi. He's from New Zealand, and he has done these sort of whimsical comedies that also have a certain dramatic element, and that works in this film. It actually makes the Thor story a work, and Thor works best when there's humor attached to it. I mean, you can have a more serious Captain America movie, but I think a Thor movie needs to be, because Thor kind of takes himself a little too seriously. So to have him in a humor-laden environment works, because he can be bombastic and godlike, and still have some fun with it. Ultimately, this film, I enjoyed the heck out of it. It looks gorgeous. It has some great action scenes. It's neat in 3D and in IMAX. The 3D elements do break down a bit in IMAX, but it's an enjoyable film. I took the whole family. I took my youngest son, who's 7. I brought my teenager, who's 14. I brought my wife. I won't tell you her age, but we all loved it. We were all laughing and cheering and having a lot of fun. And that's what this movie is. Does it propel the overall arching story leading to Infinity War? It nudges it along here and there. But it doesn't need to be that way. I remember going back and reading the comics of comic books when I was a kid. You want to have the one-off stories. You want to have these smaller movies. I mean, it's still a big movie, but, you know, it's not the Avengers. It's a smaller movie. And I like the fact that they're giving the movies the breadth or the depth or narrowing them up as they need to. That's why I liked Ant-Man. I thought Ant-Man was a neat little introduction to a character that didn't need to be any bigger than it was. No pun intended. So when it comes to Thor Ragnarok, I enjoy it. And I've always worried about the Thor movies, because the Thor movies are this interstellar cosmic kind of film, and the Marvel studios have been able to make it digestible and understandable and relatable to everybody, even though very little of it actually takes place on Earth. So ultimately, I'm going to say that Thor Ragnarok totally rocks. Thor Ragnarok totally Ragnarocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Let me say one real quick thing before we move on to the next movie about Thor and the Marvel movies. I actually saw somebody deriding this movie because they said nothing happens in it and they're sick and tired of the Marvel formula. And that's a fair complaint, but I have to disagree with him on that. This movie does have stuff happen. Stuff happens for Thor and stuff happens to Asgard and stuff happens for Loki and stuff happens for the Incredible Hulk or for Bruce Banner. But every movie doesn't have to be the biggest movie that begins and ends the universe. And that's kind of what I like. I like the fact that Marvel is doing different things with their movies. Like Doctor Strange wasn't about destroying a city. It was about putting a city back together. And Civil War wasn't about having a giant battle across an entire city. The battle took place in an airport. And even a movie like Ant-Man was not about even anything big. It didn't even spin into the stuff with the Avengers, except for one little thing where he shows up at the Avengers place and fights the Falcon. I mean, I like the idea that they're segmenting these things and they're compartmentalizing them and still making a good movie. Everybody's gotten used to the characters and now you can have some fun in it. And that's exactly what happens with Thor Ragnarok. They just have fun. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the killing of a sacred deer. A brilliant heart surgeon is haunted by the son of a man who died on his operating table after the boy threatens his family in return.
They're gonna see us from outer space.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about Pod.
It's nothing serious.
No, it is.
Like we're the stars of the human race, giving love to the world.
How did his father die?
A surgeon never kills a patient. An anesthesiologist can kill a patient, but a surgeon never can.
Cause we got the fire.
Don't be scared, Mom. You'll see. You won't be able to move either. But to get used to it.
Where is she? What did you do to her?
This is written and directed by, and I think I'm saying his name right, Yorgos Lanthimos, who did Dogtooth and more recently The Lobster. Now, I saw The Lobster. I actually haven't seen his other films. But I saw The Lobster and I enjoyed The Lobster. And Colin Farrell was in that. And part of the reason I like The Lobster is his films sort of take place in this awkwardly weird existence where it's essentially our humanity, but that there's something that's different about it. And in The Lobster, it was this deconstruction of human relationships of men and women and gay or straight and the approach of why you need to have a relationship. And it dissects that and it deconstructs that. And I thought that was interesting. And because he set this world up to really be a different existence than ours, it made sense. And so his dialogue also tends to be very stilted, deliberately stilted, and not adhering to normal social norms. Like he's talking about to a friend, he's talking about to this kid, he introduces him to his daughter and talks about when she got her first menstrual cycle. You never would say that in regular company, but that's the universe that this exists in. So I think that quirkiness is interesting, but it doesn't seem to like exist in a different world than ours. It just seems to be weird people in our world, which doesn't quite wash as well. It gives a surreal nature, but it's not surreal enough. And just the weird dialogue and the strange events that happen in here don't isolate it enough from the real world to make it an interesting movie to me. It just kind of gets in its own way. Now, the crux of the story is this somehow, this son is causing his family to get sick and they lose the function of their legs. And it's basically him being a plague on their family. They originally thought they were trying to be nice to him, but he's actually seeking revenge. And again, because it exists kind of in a different world, it could work, but this just doesn't seem to fit in the natural world. Now, it's shot in Cincinnati, and I live near Cincinnati. I live about an hour and a half away. So if you're in Cincinnati and you want to see your own city somewhat displayed on the big screen, you can. It's an intriguing movie. It's a movie I wouldn't mind watching again just to kind of fully digest, but kind of disappointed in it. I really liked what they did with The Lobster. I didn't think it was a perfect movie, but I thought that The Lobster had a lot more to say than this movie does. I think it doesn't quite stick the landing. It's not as good of a movie as The Lobster. And I think it becomes too obtuse for its own good at times. So I'm going to have to say The Killing of a Sacred Deer kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review The Florida Project, talk about box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Alfred Hitchcock. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and do our final movie of the week. And that is The Florida Project. The life of the residents in a Florida long-stay motel are profiled in this raw docudrama.
The man who lives in here gets arrested a lot.
These are the rooms we're not supposed to go in.
But let's go anyway.
Could you give us some change, please?
The doctor said we have asthma and we gotta eat ice cream right away.
Here you go.
Hey, Lee, got a situation here. Open up.
I failed as a mother, Moni.
Yeah, Mom, you're a disgrace.
This is directed by the guy who did Tangerine. And if you remember Tangerine from a couple of years ago, it was all shot on an iPhone. That movie was. Not this one, I don't think. And it was a story about a transgender prostitute. It's just a kind of a day in the life movie. It was a very visceral, on the ground kind of movie. This is a little bit of a bigger film. He doesn't have to shoot it all on an iPhone. He doesn't have to do it guerrilla style. He can do it as a regular movie. And you've got Willem Dafoe as one of the characters. He plays the manager of the motel. It's juxtaposing these people who live in this, this motel, this long stay motel. It's juxtaposing them with the high class entertainment of Disney World, which is right there on that same exit. And the whole thing is this motel is a dump. It's a place where people who take drugs and do prostitution live. And it shows, let's just say the much lower class of people. Now, it has these couple kids in it. One of them's a daughter of the main character and she's having a lot of problems. And these kids who play the roles, they're adorable kids and they're hilarious. And there's moments where they're raw and they're yelling at each other and they're using language that little kids shouldn't be using. They're exposed to behavior and ideas and stuff that the kids shouldn't be. And they're obnoxious kids. And it shows how they would go around and try and, you know, beg for money so they can get ice cream. And that's basically their life in the summer. A lot of times unsupervised, a lot of times inappropriate. But the reality is this stuff does happen. Now, these kids are adorable and hilarious in this movie. They are not adorable and hilarious encountering children like this in real life. It's sort of like a horror movie where in a horror movie where you got a serial killer hacking people up, nobody really wants to be in that situation, but it's kind of entertaining to watch in a movie because you're in a safe space. And in this one, you're in a safe space. You're watching these kids being obnoxious and doing things that they shouldn't be doing and reacting in a way they shouldn't be. But it's all kind of a safe zone because they're not really doing that to you. I imagine if you went to go see this movie and you had kids running around the theater screaming and yelling, that those kids would be irritating to you. On screen, they're funny and cute and adorable. But it's also just the story of, it's the story of people who live below the poverty line is what it is. And the main focus is this girl and her mom is, her mom's a real hot mess and she runs scams and then she tries prostitution and she's worked as a stripper and she's all tatted up. The very typical kind of white trash attitude of that expects the world to bend to her will, even though it doesn't. And she gets very aggressive and insulting and does not know how to handle conflict, which I've seen in real life. And again, it's okay to watch and you can feel sympathy for her because there's that veneer of the movie screen that's between you and what's going on in there. So while a lot of the behavior and a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie is aggressively problematic in real life, by watching this, you can understand people's problems a little bit better. And it does get you a chance to look at how some people have to live. Sometimes it's by their own doing. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes they're along for the rides like the kids. The children don't have a say in all this. And so you get to see it from their perspective as kids. And I think this movie is a very valuable movie because you can see the perspective of the adults and the kids and Willem Dafoe, who's the manager, who's trying to just keep everybody safe and everybody happy. But life keeps throwing curveballs. So it's an interesting movie. Very funny at times, but also a little bit heartbreaking. I'm going to have to say The Florida Project kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office real quick. It was no big surprise that Jigsaw won the box office. It was actually kind of low for what the Saw movies have been in the past. It made just under $17 million, which is the lowest Saw movie, and not a big surprise. I mean, the movie's still going to make money because the budget was like $10 million. And when this thing's done with its run, it'll probably top out around $40 million, if that. And Boo 2 came in with second with $10 million. Thank You for Your Service predictably bombed, because if only The Brave didn't do well the week before, Thank You for Your Service wasn't going to do well in its second week. Suburbicon bombed, and I think Suburbicon bombed because it had an overbearing racial message that was not consistent with the rest of the movie. Plus, I think they mismarketed it as a comedy. It's not really a comedy. I consider it a comedy because I like dark comedies, but it's not Bad Moms Christmas. That's the big thing. And then Let There Be Light made less than $2 million, didn't even make it in the top 10. And I want to address something here because, and this is, I'm not picking a fight with Sean Hannity or anything like that, but I have to correct a couple things. And he's close to the project because he helped produce it. And that's fine. You're promoting your project. That's your job. You're the producer of this movie. Promote it all you want. But he's been out there treating it like it's a hit. It's not. And one of the things he tweeted out this weekend, that the per screen box office average, it's the number two movie in the country if you take it by box office. That's not true. If you actually look at the weekend box office per screen, the number one movie was The Square, then God's Own Country, then Novitiate, then Bill Nye Science Guy, then Killing a Sacred Deer, then Mansfield 66-67, then Jane, then Jigsaw, then Let There Be Light. It is the ninth highest per screen average. And this happens with independent films. Independent films are in a smaller number of theaters, so it concentrates the audience, and that tends to happen. That's why The Square made almost $20,000 per screen. It was on four screens. Now, for 373 screens, that's not bad. For Let There Be Light, if he's going to quantify it as saying any movie that had a release of over 200, 300 screens. And it's not a great number. If you're actually comparing it to Christian movies, it's kind of way down there. You got to filter out Passion of the Christ and the Chronicles of Narnia and stuff like that, the big, huge budget movies. And there's a reason for this. It used to be that Christian movies and faith-based movies just didn't get released because it costs money to make film prints, and it costs money to hire a company to get them all out there and to ship all the film prints. Well, now you can use digital hard drives, and it's a lot cheaper to make film prints. And with digital cinemas, you can ship these hard drives out to all the different theaters, and you can put it in 300, 400, 500, 1,000 theaters much, much easier. But if you go back historically, like 7 or 8 years ago, there were only a handful of movies that ever got released. You'd maybe have 5 or 6 in the entire year that were considered faith-based movies. And that included stuff like The Chronicles of Narnia. And it was about 2014, 2013, when suddenly the digital theaters provided a platform and people realized that the movies could make money with a movie like God's Not Dead or Heaven Is For Real or even Mom's Night Out, which was a small little comedy that wasn't overtly Christian, but it had a faith base to it. And then if you look at the last 3-4 years, there are dozens of movies that have come out that are faith-based. And even right now, there are currently 5 faith-based movies in the theaters as we speak. And what that does is it dilutes your audience. And it's a marketplace thing. It used to be that if you had one movie come out every couple months, then you could get church groups to go. And then people, like my mom goes and sees movies with her friends from church all the time, every Friday. But if you have a new one coming out every week or multiple ones each week, they're not going to go see all the movies. And so now when you've got 24 faith-based movies being released in theaters each year, everyone has a lot more choices. And that's also nothing special. And a lot of people just wait till they come to video. It's nothing special anymore. So Let There Be Life kind of bombed. And we might see a regression effect with this. And we might see fewer of these movies because these movies aren't doing as well. I think the last big hit of these was War Room. And I think that was like 2 or 3 years ago. So we have to be realistic here. And unfortunately, Let There Be Light's not doing well. I've not seen it, so I don't know whether it's a good movie or not. But let's not pretend that it's something it's not. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I got a box set recently, the Alfred Hitchcock Masterpiece Collection, which has 15 of his movies. It's obviously not all of his films. And it's got the big ones like Psycho and the Birds and Vertigo, Rear Window, all these, the main ones, the 4 or 5 main ones that everyone knows him for. But it has some smaller ones that maybe people haven't seen, like Saboteur. And it has some of his later stuff like Family Plot and Frenzy. And I started watching, I showed The Birds to my family this week, and it's a lot of fun. It's neat to rewatch these movies, and it's nice to have them in a box set. Now, they've got a new one coming out, The Ultimate Collection, which came out in October, and there's 2 bonus discs that have extra features on it. That's the big difference between the Masterpiece Collection. But, you know, hey, Christmas is coming up, and if you got a Hitchcock fan, this is a good box set. The only other movies that are out this week for DVD and Blu-ray, you've got The Dark Tower and Kidnap, and that is it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Murder on the Orient Express, Wonderstruck, and Daddy's Home 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.